challenge in that when content comes in-house and the feature films, they get used in a variety of forms. First place that it'll typically go is into our linear encode environment. So we'll take a piece of videotape, load it into a deck, and encode it into a proprietary MPEG-2 format that works only on our broadcast playback servers. We'll then take the same piece of content into our linear encode room and encode it into a Helix format for use on a product called Stars Ticket. It's a partnership with Real Networks. We'll take the same piece of content and encode it again into Windows Media format for use on a product called Vongo. Take the same piece of content encoded into another proprietary Avid format for use in an edit bay. We'll encode them into Flash, and the list goes on and on and on. And all these touches of tape is expensive in equipment hours and people to actually manage the content as it moves around the building. And people actually doing the encode process. It's a real-time process. If it's a two-hour movie, somebody's going to sit there for 2 hours and watch the content. If we encode it 5 times, that's 10 hours worth of man time for the same piece of content. The goal was get out of the business of capturing the content multiple times and capture it once, transcode it from that file into all the different deliverables that we could possibly need. So we set out trying to find a vendor that had a solution that would allow us to have this one mezzanine file format and transcode from that into the plethora of deliverables we have. We didn't really find any one vendor that had what we needed. There was a collection of vendors that had parts and pieces of what we were looking for. So we had to set about building something to kind of combine all those pieces together to make it into a single solution. We rapidly found that because of some of the more complicated elements we were trying to add to the content, for example, on our Vongo service, which is the Windows Media content, there is a rating graphic that goes at the beginning, so it's a generic blue swishy background. Over the blue swishy background, we have to add a voiceover that says the following feature is rated R. We have to add a graphical element for the actual rating, so obviously the R logo that appears. And then following that, a collection of advisory saying why the content is rated R. Throughout the movie, we have a little logo, the Stars logo, fades in and fades out throughout the movie. About once every 15 minutes, it's on the screen for about a minute. Typically, all that would have had to been done in a linear edit bay, which is basically tape to tape. So you're playing back from one tape, inserting the graphic and recording it onto another tape. So a slow and arduous process. So we needed to get that rolled into the transcoding. As I was saying, we had to use multiple different vendors. So Vendor X could create Windows Media, and we wrote the software to tell it, hey, we want a logo to come in at 15 minutes into this content for a minute. We'd then have to replicate that work for Vendor Y to say that when we're creating the Helix content, that we also want a logo to come in 15 minutes into the content for 1 minute. So every time we add an effect to one service, we had to replicate our work several times to make it talk to all the different vendors we had in the mix here to get the same functionality across all the services. So at that point, it was time to take a step back and rethink how we were doing this. And we started with what environment can we get the most readily available codecs for. We need Windows Media, we need Helix, we need Flash, we need MPEG-2, MPEG-4, we need Muxes to be able to pull these things together. And it kind of became apparent that Windows Media Player actually does a lot of this stuff already. You can take pretty much any file and play it back in the Windows Media environment, provided you have codecs on the machine. So we set about trying to discover what is it behind Windows Media Player that's allowing it to do this. And we came across a technology that was to me, I'd never heard of this before, but DirectShow. So we went down this path. What is it that DirectShow actually does and how is it doing it? And it proved to be a platform that we could leverage to get exactly what we wanted. It was a modular approach to bolting media processing objects together. So we have an object that can decode an ASF wrapper and give us out the compressed Windows Media Stream and compressed Windows Media Audio Stream. We can then put filters downstream of those that decompresses the video stream, leave the audio stream intact, add a logo by doing some keying, recompress the video stream, put it back into another wrapper and hand the audio back in, or just affect the audio without affecting the video. But it allowed us to break out all these individual streams very easily, and by creating very small modules of code that all bolted together fairly seamlessly. The next challenge was to be able to take that and wrap it in a fashion that would allow us to easily automate the construction of these graphs to process content based on business rules, based on templates, to schedule the frequency at which a graphic was going to appear, where it was going to appear on the screen, how translucent it was going to be, so on and so forth. So what we started doing is actually putting C++ managed wrappers around the COM objects that actually are the directory of filters themselves. Some of the filters we had to create ourselves, some of the filters we were able to license. But we found that there was a very large offering of off-the-shelf direct show codecs and DMOs that did the bulk of the work that we were after, leaving very little for us actually to have to implement in that space. So most of the work is really around the management of it. So the center of the solution is obviously the storage piece where all the content is going to arrive. So we put in place about 200 terabytes of spinning disk. You can't actually present 200 terabytes as a single LUN to an operating system, so we put a network file system in place. It's called StoreNext. And what this does is brokers all the file locking and allocation of the space within the SAM for the operating system to actually try and write to it. So if we were to add one of the first devices into our architecture here, which is going to be an encoder, code 0.1, so it will talk TCP to the StoreNext metadata controller to say, hey, I need to write a file. I would like to have X number of blocks to begin with. Storage metadata controller will respond and say, okay, you're going to write to LUN 7, offset, and tell it whereabouts on that LUN it wants to write. So the connection between here and here is actually on 2 gigabit fiber. And there's multiple connections going in here. So then on the encode side here, we'll actually expand out and have multiple encoders, so encode 1 through encode X. Each server talking to the StoreNext controller to get its allocation of space to write to as it goes. These servers are Windows 2003 server. They're running 32-bit currently because of the drive availability for the capture cards that go in here. So each one of these servers has 4 video capture cards. So this is taking digital uncompressed video in and presenting that video as basically uncompressed data in memory. We then have written some direct show filters that run inside these servers, accessing the memory on these video cards and passing the samples along downstream within the filter graphs, where on the capture side, we typically just write them straight to file. So these streams getting dumped to files that are being written. Whoops, being written over here in the SAM. Due to the size of these files, I mean, a single high-def movie will end up being just over 2 terabytes. We really don't want to be moving these things around. So once they hit the SAN, they stay on the SAN. There's no other storage in the environment. The elements that are getting captured just for any one stream, we obviously have the basic video stream. Then there'll be stereo primary language, stereo secondary language, 6 channels of surround sound, so front, left, right, center, low frequency, surround, left and right. They will also have what's called Dolby E, not to be confused with normal Dolby Digital that you'd see in a consumer environment. This is a broadcast-specific environment that lets us squeeze 8 channels worth of data into the space normally occupied by 2. So on a single stereo pair, we can get 8 channels of data in there. And Dolby E is actually used later downstream in our playout environment. So in this environment, we're not actually going to do anything other than pass it through. We're going to preserve it exactly the way it came in. We're going to put it back out the way it came in as well. The other elements are the pieces that we're actually going to be manipulating in this environment. So having got some content in here, it's now time to actually do something with it. The first thing we want to do is get these captured files down from 2 terabytes in size into something that's a little more economical to keep around. We've chosen the Microsoft PC1 codec as the mezzanine codec. So we're using variable bit rate quality constrained algorithm for that. So we think they end up averaging somewhere around 100 megabits a second as opposed to 1.5 gigabits, which is the uncompressed video stream. So to get there, we need to add the transcoder to the mix. Again, same as we had Windows 2003 server over here. In this environment, we actually are running 64-bit because there's no limitation with the video capture cards. Again, the SAN attached with multiple 2-gig fibers talking to the StorNex metadata controller to get space in the SAN. So this 200 terabytes is all presented as a single drive letter. Makes the management of storage a lot easier. We don't have to worry about filling up if we broke it into 200 1-terabyte LUNs. You don't have to worry about having multiple 100-terabyte LUNs that are close to being full but don't have enough space to actually get another file into them. So you get a lot of waste. By putting it all into one file system, you gain that efficiency back. Right now we have, I think it's about 16 transcoders online. So 1 through 16. So the transcode software running in here, again, direct show based, the actual application launches on demand. So when a job gets put into the environment, said, I would like to convert, let's pick a movie, Pirates of the Caribbean 3 from its very high bitrate, uncompressed HD capture format into the much lower bitrate VC1 codec, a message will actually go out to all the transcoders saying, I have this job, who is the most capable of performing this action for me? And based on resources available on each of the devices, they'll respond with how capable they are to execute that job. And then the appropriate one will be chosen by a central resource broker. A central resource piece that's managing all these workflows is, again, 2003 server, x64. And on here, we're running the Windows Workflow Foundation as the core for trafficking all the tasks, the jobs, for persisting the information about the job state, so on and so forth. We've created some custom services that plug into the Workflow Foundation for actually brokering these messages. So in a workflow, when a transcode is needed, there's an activity that submits the request, I need a transcode for this this job definition. The service in here that's then coming out, it's actually discovering the services. So we've used the WCF, the WCC3 discovery protocol document, and she took one of the samples from the Microsoft.NET website, and she showed how to implement discovery in WCF to actually find all these services running out here. So finally find a machine that's capable of doing the job for us. It'll create a new process on that machine to run the transcode in. That gives us the ability to kill individual processes if something goes wrong without stopping anything that's running physically on the machine. While actually running here, they don't require any communication from the outside world. If you want to know what's going on with them, you actually have to go in and poll them. The idea there being that we can shut down any one piece of the system, have it come back up, and you haven't lost any time. One of the problems we had in the first attempt at doing this is if any of the central information went away, the transcoders were actually reliant upon that for information about what they were supposed to be doing. And once their systems went away, you'd actually lose the job information, or if the job completed here while the system was down, again, you'd lose the effort. And these transcodes can take upwards of 16 hours for a large movie. So obviously losing 16 hours worth of work is not desirable. Other services that are plugged into the workflow piece, Windows Workflow Foundation, we have a service exposed on there where you can actually hand in a chunk of XAML, the XAML workflow format, and we use that for actually making requests to the system. So on a client workstation, we can build a request for something to happen. So it would take information saying, I want to take Pirates of the Caribbean 3, and I want you to deliver it with a blue swish on the end, blue swish on the beginning. I want it in a VC1 format, 1.3 megabit, so on and so forth. When you finish creating it, I'd like you to send me an email. I want you to do an FTP upload to this site, make me a pot of coffee, and bring me dinner. All those pieces can be assembled in our client application, again, just building a XAML workflow, so it's completely dynamic as to what is actually going to be entailed in this task. Submit that XAML to the workflow engine, where it's then loaded back into actual classes or deserialized to the classes that represented those activities and all the appropriate binding performed so that information flows from one activity to the other. So that's how we actually post a job into the environment saying that we actually want a piece of content rendered. It in turn may spawn more workflows. So if we post a request in to say, I would like parts of the Caribbean to be rendered out in this 1.3 megabit VC1 format, and we haven't actually captured that content yet. We know about the tape, but we haven't actually done the capture. It in turn will post a message back into itself saying, hey, I need this piece of content to be captured before I can transcode it into anything. And it will recurse through itself as many times as it has to actually get all the different levels of file that it needs in that environment. All this metadata is actually being stored in SQL 2005. We went down the SQL 2005 path because a lot of the data we're storing is not hierarchical, so we need to keep it in an XML format. So we're actually storing XML blobs or chunks in the database and then using a lot of XPath stuff on the SQL engine to return the metadata that we're interested in or find the kind of objects that we're after. So one of the key things about using the Windows Workflow Foundation engine here was that we have these very long-running tasks. So we need an environment that's going to allow us to persist these tasks to a database, to somewhere where they can later be revived once the process that they're waiting upon is completed, whether it be a human process of physically putting a tape into a machine, maybe it's even finding the tape before it gets put in there, or if it's waiting the 16 hours, however long it may be, for a transcode to complete. Those workflows obviously need to be woken up if anything changes in the environment. We need to be able to create a lot of our own custom activities. There's not really anything out of the box, per se, in a workflow environment that we use, with the exception of maybe a while loop and an if-else branch. So there's a lot of custom components in there, talking to custom back-end services. Obviously, the ability to create our own pluggable services for the environment, to be able to instantiate workflows, to be able to do communication backwards and forwards between running workflows, and to actually provide the interface between the activity and the external system. We don't want an activity in a workflow to be the communication point between an external service, because that means the workflow can now not be persisted. It needs to be event-driven to wake it back up. So the Workflow Foundation seemed the logical direction to go that way. It's very easy to develop in that environment. There's a lot of tools in Visual Studio 2008 that made the development and deployment of these workflows very simple for both code-based and XAML-based workflows. And we try and stick, for the most part, to XAML, makes changing workflows at runtime a lot easier. And compatibility is less of an issue in when you compile a workflow and it's been persisted, it needs to know which version of the assembly it was that workflow came from, so that when it then deserializes, it can set all the appropriate properties. If you're doing class or code-based workflows and you make a change to that, obviously there's a new property that needs to be set, so you now have to start running multiple versions of the same code at different assemblies, and they all need to be present for the workflows that have been persisted to continue. So obviously, XAML is the preference there. All the activities being code-based, workflows being XAML-based. Another nice thing that's going to come out of the whole .NET 3.0, 3.5 architecture, not only the XAML for the workflows, but the XAML for WPF. So within a workflow, we're coming up with a lot of human tasks. For example, I need a tape to be loaded into a machine, or I've just created this file, I need a human to verify that what I created is correct, that it's the audio levels are right, there's video throughout. If there's an issue with something, we create a human task to have the issue fixed. Each of those tasks needs to have a different look and feel on the client workstation. So rather than having to redeploy the client-side components every time we make a change or every time we add a feature, what we ended up doing is actually having the workflow dynamically build XAML for WPF forms. So if I need to have a human insert a tape into a machine, the workflow actually builds at runtime the XAML that will represent the controls, the look, the feel of what the user data entry form should look like on the client workstation. That's obviously sent as XML to the client, where it's then rendered. and looks as if it was a custom written control that was actually physically on that machine. It's also allowed us to do a lot of link binding, so we can actually connect the controls that we are building dynamically to other controls that are actually true code-based controls. An example being, we have a component on the client side that's a basic machine control panel. It's got stop, play, fast forward, rewind, pause, jog, shuttle, normal kind of things you need to be able to move a tape transport backwards and forwards. Go back to the load tape workflow. When we send the dynamic form across for that, it will list what the endpoint's supposed to be and what the outpoint's supposed to be, and if relevant, what time code the start of credits occur at. And rather than just displaying them as numbers on the form and having the operator queue the deck to that point to check it, we're able to put a button on the screen, convert the text time code that appeared on the form into frames, and link that button to the class that represents that machine control panel at runtime, and now a completely dynamic form is controlling or interacting and calling methods on code-based interfaces. And that was huge. That means we can now very quickly change the look and feel of any of the interfaces that are human tasks. They can dynamically change the number of controls, the kind of controls, and the requirements or the required client-side components without ever having to redeploy a client application.